Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hello, it's Healthy Gut Girl, Kitty Martone, and this is Stuff Your Doctor Should Know. I'm coming to you live from deep inside your large intestine, and I am going through such a transitional phase of learning about health, and it's really cool, and I hope you're following me through this journey, especially those of you who have been listening to me for such a long time, and from the beginning, and can see this transition happening, you know, this focus on thyroid, just getting, like peeling the onion, the layers of the onion away, and finding that there are deeper levels to go to with healing different imbalances in the body. And it's so cool because I think you have to be very open to these things. Otherwise, if you're just married to the information that, you know, that you've learned that might be helping you, and you don't open up your mind, you don't open up the possibility that maybe you don't know everything. You know, because a lot of practitioners do that. And I'm sure I have done that. I mean, I have, you know, my whole branding is healthy gut girl and focused on gut health. And though I don't think that that has changed through this transition of me learning about the thyroid, in fact, it's enhanced the importance of, you know, healthy digestion. But I do think that without this new information that I'm, you know, gaining, I'm not really able to fully help certain people with certain conditions. And so something that my guest today has in spades is just patience, you know, is talking about, you know, having the time, like making the time to be patient about investigating those things that you need for your own health. And I know, you know, time is precious and not everybody has that luxury, but it's kind of what we need in order to really get healthy and overcome a lot of these challenges that so many people suffer from. So this man is incredible. I'm really excited to introduce him to you. He's part of that same circle of people that I have been introduced to recently, the sort of the repeat crowd. I don't know that he would call himself that. He's definitely doing forging his own paths. Okay, so he is a researcher, and he's got this incredible background of how he ended up doing what he's doing. His name is Tomo Littlewood, and he has a GoFundMe. And I think this is something that so many of us should try to contribute to, because this is what it says. He says, "I want to change the conversation around appropriate diagnosis of thyroid hormone disease. Mounting pollution and stress has multiple effects on how thyroid hormones and their actions are produced and expressed. My goal is to add to the already well-documented effects of pollutants on thyroid disease, which can affect reproduction, mood, energy, digestion, sleep, and increase systemic inflammation. Chronic and underdiagnosed thyroid disease has vast implications to each generation ahead of us, affecting not just fertility, but increasing susceptibility to disease." This is so profound, this statement, because there are not a lot of people, there are not a lot of universities, there are not a lot of researchers out there researching the effects of xenoestrogens and these toxins. I know there are more now than before, but when we talk about, for those of you that are in the estrogen dominant support group, and for those of you who aren't but are suffering from hormone imbalance and your conventional doctor is not able to help you, which is so common with hormones and gut health. So it's these confusing components, these confusing variables that are not studied enough that we can't that don't allow us to find answers, right? Because nobody knows. My big question for him, you'll hear me ask this, is, you know, how do xenoestrogens play a part in our testing of our hormones? Do they read as high estrogen? Do they read as estrogen? Do they come up in blood as estrogen? Or are they hidden and acting on estrogen receptors? Same with, like, in the Dutch test, in the urine or in serum or in saliva. Like, how does it show up and how can we measure them to know, okay, maybe we have low estrogen levels in the body, but we're having high estrogen symptoms. Why? And are xenoestrogens playing a role? So the work he's doing, I think, is profoundly important for the future of medicine. And I don't even want to say medicine, just like people helping themselves and practitioners who do their own work, like who do their own research and try to help their clients through the research and data that they can find online. This stuff is super important. Anyway, I'm rambling a little bit, but I'm very excited about this guest. He is so smart. And I want you to, once again, take out a pen and paper and take some notes. He's very good. You're going to want to listen a couple times. And I hope he helps you as much as he's already helped me. All right. Talk to you soon.
I was a personal trainer from like 1995 to about 2005. And then I got more into rehab. I did some studying out in the States at the Czech Institute a long time ago.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And then I got more into pain therapy and rehab. And then about 2010, I got into kind of reading Ray Peet's work. And looked at all his references, St. Georgie, Sellier, Katharina Dalton, and that kind of spurred my interest to go back to uni to study hormones. So kind of 2010, I stopped training people, still did consulting. And then 2020, I decided to just give up therapy, full stop, and just go into coaching and research.
Oh, that's nice. That's a nice transition too, because yeah. I'm sure how my husband's a chiropractor and he does quite a bit of physical, you know, body work as well. So yeah. I know after years and years of doing that, how it could take a toll on you physically. So it must be nice to be taking a break and just doing coaching.
Yeah, it's nice. I'm just trying to work out how to do it because I start the research in September and that's 50% of my week. So it's going to be a juggle to get everything done, but looking forward to it.
Okay. Oh my goodness. This is exciting. I love that you said Katharina Dalton and of course, Ray Peet. So yeah. I've gone down this Ray Peet rabbit hole myself over the last several months. And I mean, I've always known of him, but just recently fell into this circle of people with reading Kate Deering's work and you know, having Georgie Dinkoff on my show. And I am the CEO of a company. This is just a year now, called Ona's Natural Plant-Based Hormones. So we do hormonal creams that are all bioidentical. Sure. And I started my journey with progesterone 7 years ago, and maybe a little longer. And I started my estrogen dominant support group on Facebook then, and now we're 20,000 members. And that's what good. We're finding is this like overall issue and vast difference between the absorption between one person and another person. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we go with the Ray Peet concept of really low dosing. And then all of a sudden we're up to 100, 200, 300, 800 milligrams, obviously not with his Progest E because that's just this little bottle of oil, but with the topical creams, anything we can do for some women to get up to those doses that we need to get them symptom free. So I had a pharmacist on my show who is an expert in this field. And she said, her name's Carol Peterson. She's a pharmacist. And she said, you know, something that's overlooked is two things. One is candida. And it can occupy receptor sites and make it difficult and make things very confusing. And then the other was xenoestrogens. And she said it's very hard to test them. So she didn't have a ton of info on that. And that's why I have you here today, because I'm hoping you can help us crack open some of the mystery behind xenoestrogens. So first of all, like what is it? What is a xenoestrogen for my new listeners?
Well, I think it's quite a broad term. Obviously the idea, it's kind of like a fake or an estrogen stimulating compound, And the idea behind it, usually in a scientific term, it's used to describe the effect that it can stimulate the estrogen receptor. Now, the estrogen receptor, and again, if you looked at any of Ray Peet's work, is one way to describe the effects of estrogen. It's the molecular binding place for where estrogen binds into its cognate receptor and then goes off to do its kind of more molecular work, you know, around in the cell, imprinting, creation of genes. But there are also broad non-molecular actions. You know, the more, if you think about thyroid hormone, it has a genomic and a non-genomic effect, the gene inducing effect versus kind of metabolic type effects. And that's the same with estrogen. We don't have just this molecular capacity. We have the capacity for estrogen to exert its effects without having a molecular action. So in the environment, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of estrogen-like compounds that exert this effect. And to the extent they can antagonize the receptor, they can agonize the receptor, they upregulate, they downregulate, they can be instrumental in creating a proliferative response. And, you know, ladies are very well versed in what the menstrual cycle does and the kind of the follicular phase and what happens when estrogen rises. The amount of glycogen that's in the kind of the uterus and the estrogen type receptors that are responsible for kind of proliferating. And I've always used the term weight training for the uterus. Mm. It was estrogen's response. And then you have the progesterone that comes in, calms everything down, differentiates tissues and gets ready for the next cycle. And also the abundance of from the corpus luteum. But to the extent that estrogen and xenoestrogens kind of combine, you have obviously this external force of estrogen and this internal level of estrogen. And for females, that can be particularly problematic because they're 10 times more likely to be low thyroid, which has a specific issue with estrogen. And they're 10 times more likely to have so-called autoimmune type diseases, which I'm not so sure that I have a reasonably different idea around autoimmunity and thyroid and estrogen, which kind of ties in what Ray Peet's talked about with Jamie Cunliffe and antibody production and why it's not the body attacking itself, but there's damage going on. It's trying to remove those specific tissues. And so I think it's useful to understand that with all this kind of stimulus from xenoestrogens and internal estrogens, they can combine to have a very disruptive effect. And then you also have kind of more broader implications with kind of vitamins and nutrition, because there's a lot of research, I mean, going back nearly 100 years, that shows how estrogen, and I think we can lump the same effect in of a xenoestrogen with a natural endogenous, whether it's estradiol, estrone, and that effect is to depress certain vitamins like vitamin B1, and you could argue vitamins throughout the complex of B vitamins, kind of preferentially depleted by estrogen, as an example. And so if you go low in B1, your ability to metabolize estrogen is substantially decreased. And also riboflavin plays into that as well. And through the whole kind of energy producing pathway, that can be disrupted. And we know that estrogen has the capacity to disrupt aerobic metabolism. And I think this can be one of the nice ins to understanding how estrogen is intricately related to cancer, because it distorts the energy producing pathways. So you get a convergence of external estrogens combining with internal estrogens or endogenously produced estrogens, and also, you know, aspects of inheritance. What's the mother passing down? What's the father passing down to their offspring? And it's usually this damaged kind of physiology that makes them more prone to estrogens. Mm-hmm. So hopefully that's kind of not too succinctly summed up that how the xenoestrogen kind of exerts its effect, but it can come from many things like brominated flame retardants, PFOs, PFOAs, plastics, phthalates, oral contraceptives. You know, the list is ubiquitous and it's been going on. I think one of the first researchers to look at not so much the effect of estrogens, but was Rachel Carson, Silent Spring, which a lot of people might have heard of, mm-hmm. which kind of was looking at how biology is being disrupted because it's these dramatic increase, and we're talking hundreds of thousands of chemical compounds that were, you know, grossly overproduced since, you know, post-production since the Second World War. And it was only after a while that I was starting to see effects, whether it was, you know, the synthetic estrogens in the pesticides like DET, DES, some of these compounds aren't easily degraded. They're there over time. They can take some compounds that have been around for 100 years still haven't degraded. And now we've got the more kind of robust ones, like PFOAs and PFAs, for example, are very robust. You know, they've been using military technology, and they just, they're very hard to break down and persist, and getting them out of tissues can be a real problem. B vitamins are very, very useful for metabolizing estrogens. So estrogen dominance can come around from a B vitamin deficiency. So okay. There's research back in the early 1940s that showed that females who are experiencing menorrhagia, you know, very heavy cycles, cystic ovaries, rampant cornification of the uterus, cancer of reproductive tissues like the ovaries and endometrium, they were, particularly in females, but also what was shown to be in laboratory rats as well, is that this B vitamin deficiency was associated with estrogen dominance. Mm-hmm. So some studies they looked at is that they ovariectomized some mice or rats, and they implanted them with estrogen to see what happened. And then they fed them a B vitamin deficient diet, particularly thiamine was one that they looked at, and riboflavin. They both had an effect where when they were depleted, the rats were maintained in permanent estrus because of the inserted estrogen pellets. But when they put adequate B vitamins back into the diet, the estrogen and kind of permanent estrus stopped. So that's where they came around with the idea that having adequate B vitamins in the diet was very, very useful for preventing estrogen dominance. So I think, you know, that there is, and perhaps we'll be talking about this as part of the strategy, there are many things that you can do to ameliorate what is potentially a very stressful and damaging environment that lends itself to this kind of hyperestrogenization.
The pamphlets inside of birth control packets used to say for many, many years that it depleted B vitamins in the body, including could make some women B6 dependent. And the pharma lobby for the birth control pill lobby to have that removed from the pamphlets, that was something that was just criminal, in my opinion. And so, you know, women just don't know, although the pamphlets are, you know, miles long. So you barely right. even get a chance, especially young women who go in to get on the pill. They're not going to read them anyway, are they? This makes sense why it's so difficult to test. Like we can't, so if, for example, I offer the Dutch test, the dried urine lab. And how is that going to affect someone when you're looking at someone's estrogen levels and looking at their metabolic pathways, the steroidal pathways, and how they're using, what they're doing with their estrogen? How can you know if these xenoestrogens are playing into those levels? Or, you know, is there any way to measure what part of a female's estrogen levels are xenoestrogens? Is that even possible?
Yeah, if you wanted to get really technical and specific with it, you can do other like urinary analytes to just to see what's going on within the urine. Because they act just generally as antagonists or agonists at estrogen receptor, you may see upregulation of estrogen-based responses. So, for example, if someone's estrogen dominant, whether it's male or female, and bearing in mind this is becoming a global issue for kind of gents as well, as having too much estrogen, mm-hmm. Is that you may see increased levels of estrogen, but then equally, just like with a blood test, it can give a good indication. But whether you can actually measure the effects of estrogen, i.e. xenoestrogens, becomes problematic. And you may need to do secondary analysis of the urine to see what's in the urine. Now, some xenoestrogens and compounds, whether it's the brominated flame retardants or the PFOAs, they can have a specific effect by activating certain enzymes within the liver. And you also get certain receptors that are part of the signaling pathway. We have something called the pregnenolone X receptor. We have the aryl hydrocarbon receptor that are activated by having these compounds within the body. And that should stimulate a degradation of these structures. Unfortunately, they also kind of degrade thyroid hormone as well. So if you were seeing, you could look at lots of different things within the urine, but I think the Dutch test isn't going to give you an idea of all those converging factors. It can give you a useful overview of estrogen, progesterone, pregnenolone, I think is one of those that's looked at within there as well. Mm-hmm. So I think it becomes, you know, inherently better to do a really good history taking with someone. But even then, you know, there's a really interesting study that came out recently that was looking at thyroid cancer patients and their exposure to brominated flame retardants. And the way they did it is they got this wristband. So anybody who had been diagnosed with thyroid cancer, they had to wear this wristband around their house. And they found that those with thyroid cancer compared to the control group had very high amounts of brominated flame retardants in the house. They were being picked up on these wristbands that antagonized the thyroid receptor. Hmm. And so that's the kind of thing that you'll be looking at from an estrogen receptor issue or an estrogen-like compound that can have an estrogen-like effect. And I think it becomes, as I said, inherently hard. You might see, you know, you could argue that, you know, the Dutch test, much like a blood test, could appear relatively normal because the interfering factor is coming out from a xenoestrogen-like compound that might not show up these effects, but yet it might increase aromatase. It might increase the conversion to from the androgens to estrogen. And that may show up in the test, but it might not, because that might not be the only pathway of disruption. And it might be that the xenoestrogen is also exerting more of an effect on thyroid hormone. As an example, we know that when thyroid goes down, estrogen goes up. You know, there's plenty of studies that show associations rather than causative factors between the incidence of estrogenic-like traits like fibroids, cystic ovaries, and also thyroid nodules. So this high estrogen-like state that has a kind of proliferative state on the reproductive tissues also might have a proliferative effect on the thyroid gland itself. And one of the interesting findings behind most people with kind of thyroid nodules and thyroid cancer sometimes is that the thyroid bloods are completely normal. So there's, again, there's a level of disruption that the blood tests aren't really picking up. And this is where I think it becomes really nice to look at the molecular aspects, which don't show everything. They show us very kind of strict, you know, structural binding of proteins and how that goes off to influence the genes. And then getting the kind of non-genomic effects, looking at the chemistries, looking at your Dutch tests, and more importantly, getting an idea of symptoms, right? Most people come to you because they have key symptoms that they just don't like. It might be PMS, it might be insomnia, it might be cramping, it might be irritability, infertility. They're the things that I think we have to look at. And I'm still a big believer is that I'll look at more symptoms than I will look at lots of tests and say, how can I get change in that particular client, despite the blood test showing normal? You know, I've seen clients with Dutch tests. I personally don't do lots of testing with clients, but if some clients do come in with Dutch tests and blood tests and things like that, I go, that's great, let's look at that. But what's the symptom that's driving that right now? Mm-hmm. Because, and then I've seen that progesterone looks great, but they've got very clear symptoms of progesterone deficiency. So then you go, but this is where you go in with the progesterone, you know, very carefully measure the dose, look at the effects, and you see these symptoms clear up. Mm-hmm. So I think whilst being, you know, the old adage of test don't guess, I think, you know, we've probably all seen our fair clients that have come in with folders that thick and they're still guessing despite doing all this testing.
Yeah, we look at it just like pieces to a puzzle, like maybe it'll give us some insight to a bigger global picture. When you say molecularly, there are testings, there are tests that you do to determine what's happening at a molecular level in that way, or?
No, not with clients. I mean, in research, yes.
Yeah, that sounds expensive.
you can do it. I mean, my research is looking, which starts in September, is going to be looking at both biochemistry effects and molecular effects of you know, xenoestrogen type compounds on thyroid physiology. How does it affect the receptor in the rat brain? How does it affect the biochemistry presentation? What are the thyroid hormones doing? What are the lipid peroxide's doing for when thyroid goes down? Can we perhaps get a better idea of why T4 doesn't work well with these clients and they still have bad or kind of hypothyroid type symptoms? So it's a piece of the puzzle where the clinical research can perhaps drive some of the ideas behind what is good and what is bad protocol, or, you know, even the nuance between person. And sometimes that just comes from working with the person and finding out what works. You can have all the information in the world, like we said.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned that wristband and the flame retardants in the home. There was this study that was someone posted in the group the other day that was of these dogs they took that they put in pants. They took these like this group of, have you heard of this? They
No.
took these socks and they put them in different types of fabrics, different materials, like 100% cotton pants, you know, 50-50 something synthetic, a polyester maybe, and something else, and took them through their estrus, I think, and then to see what happened and who stopped the obviously the ones that were wearing the synthetic fabrics. It affected their estrus and what happened with them when they went into heat or if they didn't. And obviously the 100% cotton dogs, cotton pants were fine throughout the entire study. And I just thought, I mean, it's definitely interesting and says a lot about what we're wearing and what we're exposing ourselves to. We don't think about those things hardly at all. But I was thinking, gosh, can't we do a study on something else that's a little bit more, you know, needed at the moment. Although, you know, in this talking about these chemicals that we're exposed to, it is a big deal. And I think what you said about the xenoestrogen, so these flame retardants, these things we're putting on our skin, everything that we're exposed to, it makes it so complicated. And so when we are doing, so when someone starts to use progesterone, and like you said, we get oftentimes they get these labs that say that almost everything is normal. In a Dutch, you can kind of see when someone's having these major symptoms of you know, estrogenic symptoms, and everything looks pretty normal. You can look at their cortisol and you can start to figure out, this looks like there might be a sluggish thyroid happening here. There might be some kind of hypometabolic state going on that we're just not seeing in the progesterone's holding the line there. Maybe the testosterone's looking a little rough, and like the DHEAS is something that goes quickly, I feel like. But in the cortisol end, it just looks insane. But again, it doesn't always go with the symptoms. So that's why these are all just little pieces to the puzzle between the what you're wearing, what you're exposing yourself to, your toxic burden, or whatever you want to call it. Talk to me a little bit more about, because people, when they have low estrogen, whether it's the Dutch or their bloods or saliva, everything comes out low estrogen. And they're maybe heading towards perimenopause and menopause. Everyone wants to get onto estrogen, and right away, oftentimes women feel better. What is going on there? We know that that's not necessary from Ray Peet's work and so many others, but that's not necessarily true, that most likely we have an estrogen load that is causing a lot of this problem. Can you just iron that out a little bit for me?
Sure. I'm just trying to get the picture of dogs wearing pants out of my head so far, but dungarees or something like that. But I think, you know, that there is so much weight behind the idea that estrogen is lost, and you still see it now. You see people say sugar causes cancer or diabetes. So you still see, you know, such a weight behind what has gone on the last 20 or 30 years. And I think if you're, it's like when you change anything, it's almost like a dietary response. If someone's gone from a high carbohydrate diet to kind of say a low carb diet because they're not metabolizing sugar very well, you're going to see a change. And if you kind of just extrapolate that to estrogen as well, is you're putting an excess of estrogen in the system. And we know that estrogen can have some specific effects. It can increase serotonin. It can probably increase adrenaline to a degree. It can increase various different aspects that create some aspect of excitability within tissues. So what could be a short-lived response may not pan out over a long period of time. And I think it becomes extremely problematic to say that someone needs HRT. Again, when you're just looking at all of these tests that either show normal or perhaps even lower, it would be normal for perhaps estrogen to be slightly lower as the ovaries fail. But again, if you're not looking at aromatase, if you're not looking at progesterone, I think it becomes very, very problematic. And I think the idea that all postmenopausal women need it, I think it is needed to a degree on some level, but I think that it's such a small amount that I've seen probably one or two clients over the last 10 years that were probably truly estrogen deficient, many, many hundreds. But I do think it can be that could be the factor that they did need it, or perhaps, you know, this stress response that's when you get stress, when you bring in something into the system that kind of gives it a bump upwards, the system often responds by going, yeah, I feel good initially. It's like often with iron infusions, when people have iron overload, more iron is going to make you feel better because you feel stressed. It's like going for a quick run. It would make you feel pretty good because the stress response, the endorphins, the heating the body tissues up can have this beneficial effect. But I think with estrogens over time, that the capacity to, let's say, destructure water, disorganize tissue, unless you're looking at the long term of that, I think you're kind of doing yourself a kind of misservice.
Mm-hmm. It's frustrating, I think, because when these women are suffering and having hot flashes and or you say hot flushes, don't you, or flushes, what do you say?
Hot flush.
You know, when you have these experiences or you know, vaginal dryness or atrophy, and then you find something that helps you and, you know, you feel better for a long time, it's so difficult. Or another example you mentioned was the iron is, yeah. You know, especially with iron, because you're being anemic, you feel horrible and you know, you're on death's door. If you're at the point where you're getting iron infusions, you know, I met Morley Robbins when I was anemic. This was several years ago, and I was having major issues with my cycles. And I was passing out. I was having these kind of catamenial type epileptic, like little seizures. It was bad. And he comes along, I meet him, and I'm just so, you know, he's so passionate about what he does. You know who Morley Robbins is, right?
Yeah, I've heard of him. He talks a bit about copper and vitamin A,
ceruloplasmin and he's, you know, not on the vitamin D train at all. He thinks it depletes the body in many other ways, but anyway, and that if you get up your magnesium and your retinol and you know, your bioavailable copper up, that your D will normalize on its own. So I had been suffering with this, and I've been working on gut health for years and teaching gut health for years. So I could not fix this one thing. I couldn't stay pregnant. I kept miscarrying, and I was having, you know, major problems with my cycles. And so I had been taking D and doing all the things, and then Morley comes along and says, you know, and I went to get one iron infusion. I didn't feel great though afterwards, but I knew I was the right thing to do, I kept thinking. And it's hard because you can die. Obviously I was very close to death. I was down 2 units of blood. I think a 7.5 hemoglobin, and you know, I wanted to commit to his protocol, and I couldn't, you know? And so I ended up with a blood transfusion, which literally saved my life. And then I was able to kind of work on those other things. But yeah. So similarly with the iron in the tissues and not available to the body the way it should be, that's the big argument with estrogen. So, you know, if I have all this adipose tissue and all this estrogen that's hiding out in my body, this toxic estrogen, but my levels are literally undetectable, you know, and then I take estrogen and I'm like, oh, I do feel better. I do. But then on the back end, I am seeing some other symptoms. It's such a hard place for these women. And I'm speaking for all these women, because I know when I bring up the idea that estrogen could potentially be the wrong route and that we should try to normalize thyroid and progesterone first and do these things that are safer before we go down that estrogen road, I'm telling you, it is a heated topic. People, literally women, are fighting and leaving the group, and it's because they don't want to let go what's working or seemingly working.
Yeah. And I think the notion about what an increase to estrogen will do, it will kind of lower thyroid hormone. It increases thyroid binding globulin. It generally leads to, if you look at the many studies around increasing estrogen, it will increase TSH over time. There's a few studies that show that actually those who take HRT are more prone to diabetes. And I think this probably follows the pathway of decreased insulin signaling, decreased pancreatic responsiveness to thyroid hormone. Remember, most of the glands or organs that we have, whether it's the liver, the pancreas, they're all thyroid dependent, and high estrogen will suppress thyroid over time. So I think the kind of obvious things around temperature are pretty useful to look at here. What's temperature and pulse doing? But again, you know, there's such a plethora and crossover of symptoms between, you know, what people are experiencing. I think for the average person, whether it's male or female, the amount of time people want to spend on analyzing what they're doing and how right it is for them is difficult for most people, whether it's, you know, the standard approach, whether it, wherever you are, it's like, I want to feel better instantly, and I want to pill to a degree. And there are some people that don't want to take pills, and, you know, but still want to kind of get better relatively quickly. And sometimes it can be years and years. I've got an old client of mine. She came to me in her early 40s, and she'd been through 20 years of estrogen therapy, including injections of Depo-Vera, been on oral contraceptives all her life. She developed such rough endometriosis, and you know, there's nothing we could do from that perspective. She had to go and have ablation surgery to remove lots of the tissue, but it wasn't until she got onto thyroid hormone that she started feeling much better. And it's you know, the muddying of the waters between interventions like estrogen and what it does to, you know, whether it's thyroid function or suppression of progesterone or, you know, changing blood sugar responses. I think there's so many different things. And then, you know, you go to the doctors, you've got 5 minutes with them. They run a test that's completely reductionist and inappropriate to diagnose anything. And then you kind of go down the route of, you know, medication after medication or hormone replacement that's perhaps not working. So yeah, it's tricky. You know, whether you go onto these things and want quick responses or are prepared for the long-term responses, it involves some effort on understanding what's going on and how you feel, and looking at the markers that I think are really good to see if something's working, which is energy, sleep, digestion, absence of pain, quality of mood, and good libido. I think they're really kind of useful, kind of broad subjects to say, yeah, I'm in a good space right now.
Yeah, that is so good. And it's seemingly simple, but it's really a good reference. It's good markers for people to look at. I love that. Kate Deering talks about that in her book. It's How to Heal Your Metabolism. And it's just so spot on in that way. You know, just look at how, so yeah, okay, maybe you don't have vaginal dryness, or maybe your libido is a little bit back, but how's your digestion and how's your sleep and all of that, and all those markers put together kind of spell it out. I think that's really spot on. Can you speak on this a little bit? When women have never had progesterone and they're on, they start to take BHRT, just the bioidentical progesterone, we have this thing that we call estrogen kickback, where if the dose isn't, if you're not serving your deficiency, if you're not, you know, getting enough of what you need as an individual, there's this estrogenic response where people think it's the progesterone, but it's all estrogenic reactions and usually worsening of their existing symptoms. And then or the big one is gaining weight. And then they say, okay, this is definitely not for me. And then they give up. And now we're realizing a lot of that has to do with the fact that still thyroid needs to be looked at so that we can have this. But can you speak on that a little bit?
But the general thing that I've seen with clients that haven't responded well to progesterone therapy is just the fact that they need more thyroid. And you can upregulate the kind of hormones like progesterone, testosterone, DHEA to a degree, and, you know, the other ones. It's like, but if your thyroid isn't working, the liver function isn't as good as it could be. Metabolism, your ability to warm tissues is decreased. And, you know, there is a subset of women that do really well with progesterone. You can see that's thermogenic and increases their body temperatures. And that's a really good sign. But if you see that the temperature doesn't respond that much and the heart rate doesn't go up, I think it's a good indicator that the thyroid is probably the missing piece. As to the effect of like estrogen dumping, I think it's really hard to qualify that unless you're doing specific tests. And again, as we talked about, it's really hard to qualify that with those, the tests that we have. But I think if they're not responding beneficially, it's usually because something else is missing. To the idea that maybe something you see that they have this, what do you say, estrogen bounce, did you say?
Kickback, yeah.
Estrogen kickback. I mean, it's plausible, because, but I just think it's like, it's something that's missing. And my thought process on that would be not inadequate thyroid, or, you know, even if it's kind of this is where the B vitamins can come in to be important again, because particularly B1 and B2 in that those first two phases of the electron transport chain and regulating energy. If you want to say a higher carbohydrate diet, you need to be on higher thiamine, because you can't process glucose efficiently. And this is where you perhaps might see more pyruvate, more glucose, and sometimes more lactate going into the bloodstream. And this is where some people think about, you know, they might be diabetic because it can't utilize glucose, but it's actually just a B vitamin that ties in with the fact that high estrogen states will lower progesterone and lower the B complex vitamins. So there are certain nuances with that that could be explained perhaps by other mechanisms. That would be my take on it.
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly seen it with most women. But then again, in our group, the people who comment are usually the people who are complaining, right? Who are not happy. Like someone's not, we rarely get someone coming in and saying, we do get it, but we rarely get someone come in and say, I just started progesterone and I feel amazing. You know, they don't. They just go on about their lives and think, wow, this is great. And they don't share it, unfortunately. And then, you know, so most everybody in the group is complaining and having these, you know, and I had the same. I mean, I had to get up really high in topical progesterone before all of my symptoms were gone. And that was up at like 800 milligrams. So we know I'm not absorbing that. There's just no way. There's something in there. The something is happening. And most likely, yeah, overlooked is the thyroid. I never for one second thought to have my thyroid checked or check my pulse, because that notion that hypothyroid means heavy set person who is, you know, slower. And that's what people would say. Oh, you must have a hyperthyroid. You have such high metabolism. You can eat anything you want. You're so skinny. You must, you know, you don't have to work out. How common is hyperthyroid?
It's there. And I think it's probably increasing more with the amount of endocrine disruptors, but I think the prevalence is more towards hypo. Even the oldest kind of thyroid researchers, you go back to Broda Barnes and the STARS, and you know, one of the most common findings of hypothyroidism was in anorexic type patients, then patients who just didn't eat appropriately. Huh. So it kind of ties in with the people who don't do well on progesterone, because some people will think, I'll take progesterone and everything will be okay. But if you haven't got the foundation right of good nutrition, managing stress, the right type of exercise, you know, it's like just throwing, not throwing more petrol on the fire, as it were, but it's just like the fire is not going to burn appropriately because you've got these blocking factors, as it were. So, you know, I think it's really important to get the foundational responses there. I think hyperthyroidism is, I've got some interesting new kind of thought process on hyperthyroidism. And I think some of the, you know, the definition of hyperthyroidism usually is their TSH is below, some people say 0.5, and that's where I think decent TSH value should be if we were looking at it. But, you know, even if it's undetectable, there are some great people who've written about thyroid, like Paul Robinson is a thyroid patient who kind of documented experiences, written some really good books. And he's of the degree that TSH should be as low as possible, because TSH is essentially, it's not a thyroid hormone, it's a pituitary hormone that responds as part of a broad response to low thyroid hormone. So if you're having to recall to the pituitary hormones, and this is where we can kind of put this into the context of menopause, is like you produce more luteinizing hormone and follicle stimulating hormone when the ovaries are failing. You produce more TSH when there's not enough thyroid available in the body. It's not, you know, assimilating properly. It's not being uptaken. It's not being utilized. You're not converting enough T4 to T3. There are many blocking factors. Could we say that actually in some states, hypothyroidism leads to hyperthyroidism? Sometimes we'll get nodules that hypersecrete thyroid hormone. Could that just be a response of decades of low thyroid function when the body is kind of just saying, look, I've had enough of this. I'm going to ramp something up here. It's not going to be great for these tissues, but I'm going to get more thyroid hormone into the body. And even with hyperthyroidism, I don't think it's going to be as bad as people make out if, but you can see a lot of women that suffer from hyperthyroidism. I guarantee that in a subsection of the client base that you look at, it would be women who haven't eaten enough, chronically stressed, and if you're running around like that, you're going to, for a lot of women do undereat. We know that. I mean, a lot of clients have come to me, and probably yourself over the decades, that they've chronically undereaten, and some are kind of gaining weight, some are thin and just don't gain weight at all because obviously they're not eating enough. Now, to the extent that someone appears hyperthyroid, you could be running off adrenaline, your heart rate could be going through the roof. When you run off adrenaline and you're burning body fats all the time and breaking down proteins, you're going to have a much worse presentation than someone that eats on a regular basis. So if you were to get someone who's eating 1500 calories that's also looking hyperthyroid, and they actually really are hyperthyroid, get them to eat 3,000 or 4,000, maybe even 5,000 calories a day, see what happens with that. Will the body calm itself down? There are ins and outs. You can slow thyroid function down by giving someone a belly full of broccoli or fish oils. That will slow the thyroid down. But if you were just to say, look, here's the amount of energy that you need, the body may compensate after time. And also, if someone's B1, B2 deficient in the B vitamins as well, there's so many different crossovers into many systems, with beriberi, for example, which is thiamine deficiency. One of those key symptoms of that is a tachycardia, heart rate over 90 beats a minute. So if you're thiamine deficient and thyroid hormone deficient, you might be, thin, cold, but your heart rate might be really, really high. And there are various different nuances to look at that to say whether one's clinically hyperthyroid just by looking at the TSH value. And chronic stress will suppress the thyroid or the pituitary response so much that you won't see TSH. In some cases, environmental pollutants push TSH right down. In some cases, they don't even create a thyroid response because there are blocking factors between the conversion of T4 to T3 and how much binding goes on actually at the receptor as well. So there's this whole level of distortion from the pituitary all the way through to the cells that need the thyroid that can make them look completely normal. And now we're dealing with more offspring that where potentially what's happened, and certainly been postulated within rodents, is that the TSH set point is altered in utero. That means the ability for the body to perceive low thyroid or high thyroid is totally altered. And so when it comes to looking at the blood test in the offspring, it can be a total misrepresentation of what's going on. And this is where you might start to see, the incidence, say, in female offspring might be cystic ovaries, might be endometriosis, might be, fibroids. And yet, to the degree that the parent can push those traits on. But if in a utero, the TSH set point is altered, you have no idea what thyroid's doing. And this is where estrogen can exert a very detrimental effect on physiology.
Unbelievable. I know this is probably not your wheelhouse, but why do women do that?
Just having the decades of conditioning from kind of media and, habits from mothers or fathers that you pick up, we all pick up to a degree. I think that's one of the most common findings that I find with clients with PCOS, right? Disordered eating as a teenager.
Or just
fail to eat, or, if they do eat, they're skipping breakfast, having, something small. It's generally an undereating thing. You can get the excess of calories and the overeating, of course. Don't get me wrong, that can occur. But again, tying into all the kind of hormone milieu that goes on, when it comes to looking at, say, PCOS, people just look at, the fact that glucose might be high. But why is glucose high? Mm-hmm. Are they thiamine deficient? Are they thyroid deficient? We know that PCOS is an estrogen dominance. In my point, some people say, it's because of high androgens. Go, well, OK, well, why is that occurring?
Yeah. Whether
it's the environmental pollutants that are driving that, combined with the inheritable traits and the dietary factors, they all converge to cause a big problem.
Right.
Just digressing slightly, there's a really interesting paper that showed that gestational diabetes was associated with the amount of, again, PFOAs or PFAs that was found in the body. It's associational. It's not causative, but they found that the higher the PFOA levels, the more likely that the female was likely to have gestational diabetes, which goes to show, and everyone would go, then you need to cut out sugar. It's the pollutants that are driving the poor glucose signaling that could be causing the problem here. And how do you get rid of that? Well, that becomes a million-dollar question, doesn't it?
Yeah, I had this great classic situation when I was working with gut health and started using progesterone. I had a client who had two babies, and she had gestational diabetes. And then she got pregnant again, and she came to me and said, "I don't know what to do. My diet, what's going on with this gestational diabetes thing? I don't want to get it again, of course." And so we did, you know, progesterone along with some diet changes, and two more children she had, and didn't have the gestational diabetes. What do you think progesterone plays into with gestational diabetes?
Well, if you go and read some of the research, that some of the suggestions are that progesterone is responsible for gestational diabetes. And I think this is muddied, because they tend to look at the progesterone receptor. And if you just look at the progesterone receptor, you need to kind of be very clear that the estrogen receptor influences the progesterone receptor. And if you're in a low blood sugar state, the glucocorticoids and also glucose will bind to the progesterone receptor. So there's milieu of different effects, but yeah. I think generally, because progesterone will act as an anti-estrogen, and it's you know, you talked about Katharina Dalton's work, and one of the main things that Katharina and Ray kind of talked about, which got me into this, was that generally hypoxia is the main reason why women tend to miscarry, you know, the first trimester. It's a very, very hypoxic state. Progesterone will influence aerobic metabolism, that like we talked about, with kind of the energy producing pathways, and that would produce more carbon dioxide, which will mean more oxygen will be dissociated. I do think progesterone can be very, very helpful here. I was kind of commenting on something like The New Scientist on Facebook the other day. They were saying out of 25,000 women who miscarried, they would have been down to genetic defects. And it's like, well, how can you say that? Because the genetic defect might come from many, you know, causative factors from the environment. The genes aren't going to do anything here. But if the parents have got inheritable traits, the environment's really shitty and harsh. Sorry for swearing. I'm not allowed to swear. I'm quite used to swearing. And, you know, you combine that with under eating, then sometimes glucose values can be high as well. It's not some, you know, most women tend to eat adequately during progesterone, but still some women do under eat, then that can increase, you know, triglyceride levels and cause problems, you know, further down the line. But I do think, generally, as a rule of thumb, progesterone, I know even with my wife was on progesterone. She took it up until the beginning of the third trimester. I can certainly pay testimony to the idea that kids are more precocious and intelligent on progesterone, because my daughter's very precocious and very smart.
Well, that's good. Yeah. Let's go back to thyroid quickly, if you don't mind. You know, now again, I'll use myself. Coming up on checking my temp and my pulse every day, every morning, and then 40 minutes after lunch, and starting to work on that and changing, you know, different foods that I'm eating. I'm taking a desiccated glandular, and then, you know, I was doing like fasting in the morning. I was doing bulletproof coffee and going to work out really hard for 20 minutes and then walking. And so that was my routine. And yeah, I was definitely losing belly fat. Now I'm gaining all this weight. Now I've gained like 8 pounds in like 3 weeks, and just all in the belly, it would seem. So I was talking to my friend Constantine, and he was saying that, you know, it's going to take some time to shift over. And I think Kate Deering's book mentions this. It's going to take time. It's not going to happen all of a sudden because you're so used to being adrenaline dominant. What is that's going to be different for everyone, or what can I expect?
Well, I think a lot of people, when they kind of start integrating more carbohydrates, like, you know, it's very common to hear that I was fasting and drinking coffee in the morning. And that has a specific pathway from, you know, upregulating stress response to a degree, and the body's kind of used to that. So in a way, it can actually make you perhaps slightly more I don't really use the term carbon tolerant, but in a not as efficient at processing glucose as you could be, and fructose as an example. So then you start incorporating more foods, more carbohydrates, and it can take a bit of time. It can be the thyroid that's missing here as well. Remember, chronic stress will do a suppress T3 over time, and it will make these thyroid bloods like TSH look completely normal. The other thing as well is increasing the amount of carbohydrate in your diet requires more thiamine. I mean, the general rule of thumb is that per 1,000 calories more, that you need an extra milligram of thiamine. But I would actually suggest there are plenty of studies, although they're low-grade clinical trials, they're not kind of robust studies. They're small case studies where some people have used, 600 milligrams of thiamine to eradicate fatigue. And these are in clients that were taking thyroxine. Now, that's another argument as well, whether thyroxine is the best thyroid hormone. Again, I don't think it is. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, increasing the amount of B vitamins relative to the amount of nutrition that you're increasing can be helpful as well. What's the right dose? I don't know. That's something you need to play around with. Mm-hmm. Equally, taking things slow. If you've gone a long time without having too many carbohydrates at breakfast, for example, start with a really small glass of orange juice or a piece of fruit. You don't have to go for big breakfasts. Just get used to it. How many people they've lost their appetite for eating in the morning. They're used to saying, "I don't feel hungry till lunchtime." Well, that's just a stress will suppress the amount of hydrochloric acid that you produce, the amount of digestive enzymes. So eating in a stress state feels quite uncomfortable because you don't have that ability to digest food and you feel a bit fuller. And then you go, "Oh, I feel kind of fuller. I feel fatigued. I feel like I can't digest it." That's just your body being stressed. So I think taking it slow to start with is going to be the key factor here. And then thinking about, the additional thiamine, B complex, thyroid as an example. Mm-hmm. You usually find that your kind of appetite comes back. And that's the thing is getting used to not being ravenous and overeating, because there's that balance between obviously getting the right amount of calories in. And I think some people, when they've kind of been used to restricting nutrients, hear, "Oh yeah, you should be eating lots more." And they actually use that as an excuse. Yes, I want to eat lots more. And then unfortunately there is amount of weight gain.
Yeah, I have definitely increased my milk and cream intake.
Yeah, and that's a very relevant point about getting excess calories from fat as well. So, mm-hmm. They can increase the calorific intake substantially. So I think that's useful. Sometimes some people might do better on lower fat products as an example. Mm-hmm. But getting adequate protein in, adequate carbs, moderate amounts of fat, so I think that could be quite useful.
It's shocking how you have to relearn how to eat, because that's really what I'm doing. And at this stage in my life, and so that's what a lot of people are having to do, is just create new habits around how they look at food, how they feel about food. And that's hard.
Yeah. And it can be relatively individual as well. So I often get clients, if they come to me from a stressy background, I get them to eat 5 or 6 meals a day, but then I might get them reverting back to 3 meals a day within the space of a few months, because that's what they do better on. Mm-hmm. And they can then tolerate going longer periods of time. But some people go through those big dips and, would go through 2 or 3 hours and slump down or get really irritable. And I think, propping up their blood sugar levels is really, really useful in the short term, because it gets them to a better place, gets them to sleep, stops premenstrual syndrome, gives them a balance throughout the day. But then sometimes going back to 3 meals a day can be one of the better things for them. Mm-hmm. It's playing around, really.
Yeah. That's what I like about Dr. Dalton. I think she really, really recommends sort of that grazing, like several meals throughout the day type of thing. And she mentions that progesterone, that topical progesterone, cannot be absorbed properly without carbohydrate. And she's the only person who I ever heard say that. But I'm sure there's some truth to that, especially women that already have insulin resistance issues. So we recommend it anyway. I'm just like, listen, just ensure absorption. Make sure you're eating, healthy carbohydrates. I'm so grateful for your time. I want to ask you a quick question. Constantine is the one who said you just have to ask him to say something quickly about this, because I knew we wouldn't have enough time to talk about all the things. But tell me a little bit about why serotonin is not the happy hormone.
Well, it's not a hormone. It's a neurotransmitter, and it's very easily upregulating the stress response. And not to say that serotonin is bad, it's not. And we kind of get the ideas that estrogen is bad, serotonin is bad. They all have a necessary place. But, one of the biggest misconceptions about serotonin is that it sends you to sleep. And it doesn't. It actually wakes you up. So that gives you an idea of the kind of action of serotonin. Serotonin is a wake-on neurotransmitter, and it's typically upregulated in insomnia. You know, one of the reasons why people who took early SSRIs had suffered from insomnia was because they had so much serotonin in around in their body. And serotonin and histamine are these wake-on neurotransmitters. Now, the stress response is mediated by serotonin. The stress response can be active in the brain. It can be active at the adrenal glands. It does need to be activated in certain areas. The serotonin will transmit the stress response. So to the extent that you have high levels of stress, you will probably have high levels of serotonin. The idea that you are serotonin deficient is not born on any meaningful diagnosis when you go to the doctor. It's based upon a questionnaire that says you must have low serotonin, therefore you must be depressed. But we know that depression can come from many pathways, including low thyroid. And serotonin is upregulated in, you know, activating these kind of protections against, you know, pollutants. It can activate, I talked about this aryl hydrocarbon receptor in the gut, it can activate that, it can activate adrenaline, it can activate the production of cortisol. So serotonin is much misaligned, and it's not maligned for the right reasons. But I think it was Ray Pete that got me on interested in that in the first place. And then I went away and studied a sleep physiology course that kind of really just said, well, that kind of makes a lot of sense, because it is serotonin that wakes you up at night. So lowering serotonin can help you to get to sleep.
Wow. Wait, so it's not adrenaline or cortisol, or it's all of those?
It's all of those. Yeah. Bearing in mind that adrenaline and cortisol can be implicated with the increase of serotonin that is part of the stress signaling response. So people often get confused by, because just melatonin, which is helps, it's not a classic sleep on transmitter, but it will help. It kind of prepares the eyes for sleep. It kind of slows the body down. It decreases core temperature to a degree and has an anti-thyroid effect to a degree. So some people do go to sleep quicker with melatonin, but it just because it's synthesized from serotonin and i.e. tryptophan, the amino acid, doesn't mean that you have a serotonin deficiency to help you to get to sleep, or nor often a melatonin deficiency. It's usually this kind of upregulation of, you know, blood sugar responses, low blood sugar. It might be inflammation that's increasing serotonin. We're all aware that, you know, the gut produces 95-97% of, you know, the body's stores of serotonin by the enterochromaffin cells. And digestive inflammation is one of those reasons why you can't get to sleep and why it wakes you up, because you produce this serotonin, and serotonin is going to keep you alert and in this stress response. And that's why, you know, getting it down can help. That's why antihistamines and antiserotonins work really, really well to get people drowsy.
That's just a whole other hour.
Yes.
At least. That's so fascinating too. So you don't really recommend melatonin, for example? I mean, probably just very individual situations.
I've never recommended it. I've never needed to recommend it. I know some people that have used it and reported some good effects from it, but I think long-term as a supplement, I think it messes with signaling too much. I've seen plenty of clients do really, really well with getting sleep by using carbon dioxide or eating enough food. You know, GABA analogs from dairy, getting enough salt or sugar in to kind of lower that adrenal stress response, as it were. You know, glycine as an inhibitory neurotransmitter. Not so much GABA, but the GABA signaling pathway. You know, these are all things that you can do without having to take melatonin. So fair play if you've tried it and it works for you. It's not my cup of tea.
Yeah, interesting. Well, I like that, because it's not just like take a pill for every ill type of mentality where it's like, okay, I have this going on, I'm going to take that, which really wraps up this whole conversation that we're talking about. You know, it's like, I'm low on iron, take iron. No, I'm low on estrogen, take estrogen. Like, it's just not all, it's usually not the case. There are other ways to go about it. You just have to be willing to dig, and you have to be patient, and you have to have good guidance. So are you taking clients?
Yes. I'm trying to squeeze clients in.
Okay, good. Well, I'll keep that in mind, because I might need to hire you. And I'll put all of your information in our show notes, and really, really want to wish you good luck with your studies, your upcoming studies. And thank you so much for your time.
Appreciate it. Yes, thanks for having me on. Thank you very much.
All right, take care.
You too. Bye.
I am super excited. I think he's probably, I know I say this a lot, but probably one of my favorite guests. Just really, and you know what he did? He's, even though he's very clinical and you can hear the biochemistry and wheels ticking in his head, you know, he simplifies things. He takes complex information and simplified it. You know, when he said the basic markers, energy, sleep, digestion, absence of pain, quality of mood, and a good libido, those markers to keep an eye on. So, okay, so here's an example. For example, there's a lot of women in the group who benefit from using estrogen, right? They use it and they say, you know, they might be in perimenopause or menopause and they start using estrogen and then they have their libido come back, or they have, you know, vaginal atrophy go away, or they have hot flashes disappear. That does not sum up a healthy person, right? That doesn't, just because the sex is good does not mean your life is back in order. Does not mean you're healthy and thriving. It's a part of it. But then we have to look at all of the different components, like, okay, so maybe the libido is good, but how's your energy? How are you sleeping? How's your digestion? Are you in pain, and the quality of your mood? And that, I loved that he brought it down to those markers. And so, you know, maybe taking the estrogen is not, it might be helping one thing, but it might be making some other things worse. Same thing that we can use that frame of thinking with vitamin D, or we can use that with iron or other, you know, certain foods, you know, or exercising. Yeah, I'm exercising every day. I'm doing CrossFit, and I feel great afterwards. But then what is it doing to me the next day? Or what's my muscle recovery like? Or what is, you know, you can use that in every way and go back to these basic markers. Yeah, I'm doing CrossFit, but my energy is terrible. My mood is horrible the next day. I'm not sleeping through the night, or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a great way to apply what he was saying. And then when he said, if you're not absorbing progesterone, you probably have a hypothyroid. You probably have sluggish thyroid. That, and just broke that right down. Just summed up every single conversation that we have in the estrogen dominance group, or my clients have for me. It's like, the progesterone isn't working, or it seems to be making me feel worse. You're probably not absorbing it because you probably have a sluggish thyroid. It's one common possibility. It's not everybody, right? There's always going to be exceptions. Anyway, it's just so thrilled to have this person. Really happy. You can find all of his information in the show notes. Please consider contributing to his GoFundMe. This will fund his research and his PhD. And I think it's really just going to help generations of people, his work. And what else? Don't forget usonas.natural. I'm sorry. Do I ever say that right? usonasnatural.com. US, oh my God, I have to edit this. Oh, geez. Okay. us.onasnatural.com. And of course, you can go onto healthygutgirl.com, click on the shop page and check that out. The price of the Dutch test that I offer, that we talked a little bit about, if you're interested in testing your hormones through your dried urine hormone analysis at home, if you are interested in taking that test, the price, they are raising their prices quite a lot, at like $100. And that's going to force me to raise my consultation fee a little bit. So prices are going to go up on July 1st, 2022. So please, if you want a book, go to healthygutgirl.com and click on make an appointment. And you can do that there. It is not a live consultation. It is email correspondence. And you can also hire Tomo Littlewood, as you heard. And I highly recommend that as well. All right, friends, thanks for joining. Woo!